Hello and welcome to the Martian Drive-In Podcast number 65. My name's Terry Frost, and this time around I'm looking at a couple of films, one 18 years old, one very, very recent. The 18-year-old movie is Gattaca, Andrew Nichols' 1997 film starring Ethan Hawke, Uma Thurman, Alan Arkin, and a bunch of other very interesting actors. And then we go to 2015 for the latest in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, being Ant-Man's, starring Paul Rudd, Evangeline Lilly, Michael Douglas, Corey Stoll, and a bunch of other people. So basically we're going from genetic engineering to tiny little men. So sit back, relax, I'll get the contact details out of the way, then we can start talking about some quality science fiction cinema. The Martian Drive-In Podcast appears every 2 weeks and is a podcast of science fiction, horror and fantasy movie appreciation. It doesn't matter what it is, it could be all the way from George Méliès through to Michael Bay, though I'm not likely to do Michael Bay. But feedback is important to me, so if you want to leave some feedback, you can leave it at cultguru, K-U-L-T-G-U-R-U, at gmail.com. You can leave it at the Martian Drive-In Podcast website, marsdrivein.blogspot.com. The other thing you can do is go over to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. So if you type in Paleo-Cinema Cafe into Facebook, you can go and leave some feedback there as well. Now, there are occasionally adult concepts in this podcast, so just keep that in mind as you listen, and sit back and enjoy the rest of the show. Okay, so how is everybody going? We're not doing too well here because this morning was the coldest morning in Melbourne for 18 years. The car was covered in ice, the cats were unhappy. It was fucking miserable, to be really honest. Now, having known and knowing a lot of people in a lot of different climate conditions, here's what I've worked out based on this. It doesn't matter how objectively cold or hot the temperature is. It's how far out of the normal range of it current temperature or the current conditions are is what messes you around. So my friends in Darwin, for instance, where it's always tropical, when it gets down below 20 degrees centigrade, they're in their big jumpers and their Ugg boots. And people I know in Canada think that it's balmy weather as long as ice doesn't freeze. But for us, it got down to about -3 here this morning. 3 centigrade, by the way, and our houses and our bodies are not used to it. So very, very cold. I put the heater on. I explained to the cats, though they didn't understand me, exactly what was going on. But from our point of view, it was shit weather this morning. The sun's out now, it's warming up a little bit, but the sooner summer rolls on, the better for me. I was born in a much more subtropical climate than this, up in Sydney, and even after 20-odd years of living in Melbourne, I still have trouble with the winter. But I think I'm always going to have that problem, so I'm kind of used to it and accustomed to it and happy with it. The fact that I'm never quite going to adjust to being in Melbourne. I've got property here now. I've got this house and I've got the mortgage, so I'm probably not going to move anytime soon. But leaving that aside, yeah, we've seen a few movies, we've hung out a little bit, we've cooked meals, we've sung songs, we've done all the other stuff that you do as a normal part of life. And on the subject of seeing movies, I probably should let you know what I have watched lately. And then I'll do a little bit of interesting feedback that I got before I do the movies. I'll do a little bit of interesting feedback. It's only going to be a minute or two, but it really blew me away when I got it. So I'm just waiting for Letterbox to kick in now because, of course, the cold weather affects everything, including my computer. No, it doesn't, but you know how it is. Almost there. There's a few things I watched. I watched that really bad 2002 Christian Bale film, Equilibrium, which I'd never seen all the way through. And basically, it's a bit of a weird film. It's kind of very grim. It's got no sense of humor at all. It's kind of a cross between 1984 and that bit in Robin and the Seven Hoods where Sammy Davis Jr. sings, dances, and shoots bottles off a bar. It's kind of like that. It's very kind of gun. There's a thing called gun-fu in it, which they called gun-carter, which is kind of like a martial art based around pistols. And that's what it reminded me of. It's a 1984 dystopian movie with a love of guns in it. And it wasn't very good. It did have some interesting actors in it. It had Taye Diggs in it. It had Sean Pertwee in it. It had Sean Bean in it. Of course, he dies very early on, as Sean Bean very often does. And, yeah, it was probably a bit of a waste of lifespan to watch that movie. It just didn't have too many virtues about it. Did see an unusual Jason Statham movie on Netflix called Blitz, which is about a London serial killer in the east of London, and Jason Statham's a rogue cop instead of being a rogue, whatever he is most of the time. Again, it had some interesting actors in it, a couple of people from Game of Thrones and things like that. A bit of a change for Jason Statham, because he's usually doing the American thing and hanging out with men who are on human growth hormone, who are much older than he is. But, yeah, it wasn't too bad. It wasn't good, it wasn't bad. It was just kind of in the middle there, Blitz. But really nice ending. I do like the ending on it. I do like the way the ending came about. And it's got Paddy Considine playing his boss, who happens to be gay. And there's a lot of homophobic slurs that Statham throws around while talking to him. But in the end, they make it quite a good buddy team. I would like to see another movie with those two characters. It'd be quite interesting. The only other thing I've seen... Oh, I just bit my lip again. I did it last night and I just did it again. The only other thing I've seen interesting, which is a film I know Dr. Zom loves, and it's 1955 Soldier of Fortune, starring Clark Gable, Susan Hayward, Michael Rennie, and a very interesting actor called Alexander Darcy, who's got the best mustache. His mustache out mustaches Clark Gable's mustache in this film. It's kind of set in 1955, as it would be, in Hong Kong, and Clark Gable plays a character who runs a whole bunch of Chinese junks, and Susan Hayward comes to him because her husband is behind communist lines in China, and her husband's played by Gene Barry, who gets very much a thankless role in this film. But it's quite nice. It's in very good CinemaScope. There's some really nice location shooting of Hong Kong in the 1950s, and it's kind of an actioner, and it's kind of a programmer kind of film, but it wasn't too bad. I didn't mind that. I picked it up with a couple of other films in a three-pack when I was looking around DVD shop, and it cost me like $10 for three movies, so I got that. The movie's by was written and based on a novel by Ernest K. Gann, the guy who did The High and the Mighty, which I just talked about recently on Paleo Cinema Podcast. And it's a two-fisted, blokey kind of adventure. It's very much of its time. But I kind of enjoyed it as well. But that's pretty much all I've been watching as far as that's concerned. One of my Netflix guilty pleasures suddenly came on for season two, and that's BoJack Horseman, the cartoon. So I've been streaming and binge-watching BoJack Horseman, which I recommend if people haven't seen it. I'm not going to do any spoilers on it. I'm not going to even tell you what it's about, but you should see it. So, that's about it for what I've been watching. Let's see, there was some news that I had to give, and I'm just trying to remember what it is. Yes, the director of Nosferatu, F.W. Murnau, someone pinched his skull from his grave, which is probably always going to be a bit of a something that may just happen if you are the director of a classic vampire film. And that's become a big news item. Someone pinched the skull of Murnau, and people are saying it's a vampire. People are saying, give the skull back. People are saying all sorts of things. But what they're not saying is that that's not the weirdest thing that's happened to F.W. Murnau. The weirdest thing is how he died. Murnau was a gay gentleman. And as so the story goes, and I don't have any solid verification for this, but I've heard this from a number of different sources. He had quite attractive Filipino houseboy, as people often did in Hollywood at that time, and he was living in Hollywood at the time. So Murnau and his houseboy is driving his limousine, his open limousine, down through the Hollywood Hills one day, and Murnau, who is sitting in the passenger seat, takes it into his head in more ways than one. Well, what he takes into his head is he's going to offer a blowjob to his houseboy, which he proceeds to do. And it's a friendly thing. They're consensual people. Big deal about that. But the downside to that was basically, the houseboy lost control of the car, it crashed, and Murnau got killed. Now, this is probably not the only time that's ever happened in human history, but it's probably the only time that it's happened to a famous director of vampire films. And I'm sorry that it happened, because I like Murnau's work a lot. He did a lot of other good things apart from Nosferatu, and if people should see his other films, particularly his 1927 film Sunrise, also known as Sunrise, A Song of Two Humans, which I highly recommend. I've seen it once, just after I saw it in a documentary that Scorsese did about the history of cinema, and you really should see that film. It's a classic. It's impressionistic, of course, and it's just a joy to watch. I'm not going to do too much about it. In fact, I want to watch it again. I'm putting it down on a list to watch again. But yes, it's gory, and yes, it's interesting. Yes, it may well even be newsworthy that Murnau's skull got nicked from his grave. But we can't forget the guy himself. Yes, he did much more than Nosferatu, and it is sad that he died when he died, because I'm sure he had a number of more films in him, and it would have been interesting to see him do some sound cinema and see what he would have done in the 1930s and even the 1940s. That would have been something that would have enriched Hollywood, or if he wasn't working in Hollywood, would have enriched cinema in general. Now, I'm just trying to find out how old he was when he died. He was only 42 when he died. So he may well have had 20 or 30 years of more movies in him, which would have taken him into, let's see, late 1950s, early 1960s. Could have happened. But, so while we're kind of giggling about Murnau's skull getting taken and the way he died, and yes, I will giggle about that slightly because I'm immature, we can't forget the guy had the chops when it came to directing cinema at a time when the art form was very, very new and things were being done and things were being invented for the first time, and he was right at the cutting edge of that. So on to the feedback that I got that I mentioned just earlier. As you know, last time around I did a review of the movie Advantageous, Jennifer Pong's really good small science fiction movie, which is on Netflix at the moment. So I put out on Twitter that it was on, the way I do with every podcast, and I got a tweet back from Jennifer Pong herself saying, at Terry Frost, thank you for the podcast and the recommend, and for getting my name correctly pronounced. Very few people know how to pronounce it. So I actually got some direct feedback from the director of the movie saying that she enjoyed the podcast. So quite happy with that. It shows how things have changed in the 21st century, where the kind of communication lines between creator and audience have become a lot shorter and a lot more direct than they ever have been previously in history. And I sent a reply back to Jennifer Pong saying, my pleasure, I look forward to seeing what you do in the future. So really chuffed about that, really happy about that, and I hope to continue to recommend good movies for people in the future. So anyway, I'm going to take a break now, and when I get back, it's going to be Gattaca.
Genetics, what can it mean? The ability to perfect the physical and mental characteristics of every unborn child.
In the not too distant future, our DNA will determine everything about us. A minute drop of blood, saliva, or a single hair determines where you can work, who you should marry, what you're capable of achieving. In a society where success is determined by science, divided by the standards of perfection, one man's only chance...
How do you expect to pull this off?
I don't know exactly.
...is to hide his own identity.
This is the last day that you're going to be you, and I'm going to be me.
...by borrowing someone else's
Congratulations.
What about the interview?
That was it.
Do you think you'd be doing what you're doing if it wasn't for who you are, what you are?
I have a feeling you might be there under false pretenses, playing somebody else's hand.
They've got my picture plastered up all over the place. They'll recognize me.
They won't recognize
me. They'll recognize me.
I don't recognize you. They won't believe that one of their elite could have suckered them all this time.
They are going to find me.
But in a place where any cell from any part of your body can betray you, how do you hide? When we all shed 500 million cells a day. Ethan Hawke. Uma Thurman. Welcome to Gattaca.
Okay, so Gattaca, 1997. I read the storyline off IMDb for you. In the not-too-distant future, a less-than-perfect man wants to travel to space. Society has categorized Vincent Freeman as less than suitable given his genetic makeup, and he has become one of the underclass of people that are only useful for menial jobs. To move ahead, he assumes the identity of Jerome Morrow, a perfect genetic specimen who is a paraplegic as a result of a car accident. With professional advice, Vincent learns how to deceive DNA and urine sampling tests. Just when he's finally scheduled for a space mission, his program director is killed and the police begin an investigation which jeopardizes his secret. So the cast, I'll go through an extended cast list because it's got some very interesting actors who are only in it for one or two scenes but whose work I enjoy. We've got Ethan Hawke playing Vincent, a.k.a. Jerome. Uma Thurman as Irene, the love interest. Jude Law playing the actual Jerome Morrow. Lauren Dean playing Anton, Vincent's brother, who turns out to be one of the investigating policemen in the murder case at Gattaca. Gore Vidal is in it as the director of the project. Xander Berkeley playing a doctor's in there. We've got Elias Koteas playing the father of Anton and Vincent. You've got Blair Underwood as a geneticist in a scene. You've got Ernest Borgnine. You've got Tony Shalhoub. Alan Arkin playing a police detective. Pretty good cast all up. There's at least one Oscar winner there, being Alan Arkin, who keeps turning up in my podcasts lately for some reason. But and some of the roles are better written than others. Uma Thurman I like a lot because I think that Uma Thurman is way sexy, and also I like her exotic look and a lot of the roles she plays as well. I really love Kill Bill, mostly because I like the way Uma Thurman puts it across. But it's a kind of a bit of a thankless role. It is a kind of love interest role. It would have been nice to see her do more. And I was thinking about this because my feminist friends have let me see the light. And this is a movie that, it had it been made, say, now, you could have done it with the gender roles reversed very, very easily. There's not much in this film that you need to change to make it about a woman of the underclass who has ambitions and wants to go to space and pretends to be another woman who's genetically perfect. All of that kind of stuff is possible. The role isn't a gender-specific role in that sense. And it would have been interesting to see it done with a woman, just for a bit of a change, because it is, for the most part, a little bit of a sausage fest. But we'll put that aside for one moment. Movie was made for about $36 million at the time, which wasn't a big budget. And financially, it was not successful. In fact, it's still a little bit controversial. When I put up on Facebook that I was going to be doing this movie, there were a couple of people saying a couple of disparaging things about the film and that they didn't quite like it. But I like it. I like it a lot. I think it's good science fiction for a start, because good science fiction is about the impact of change on human beings. And that's at the heart of this film, the fact that somebody who wasn't genetically designed at the time of conception, where they hadn't winnowed out all of the dodgy eggs, the genetically imperfect embryos, and only allowed the ones that had all the ticked all the boxes to turn into human beings. That's a big impact on society. It's a big change on society. There are some bits where it's put across kind of weakly. I don't believe for a second, for instance, that people don't look at each other's faces. And you can't really recognize that the guy on the screen isn't the guy standing in front of you. We're wired to read faces from a deep, deep and ancient genetic level. We need to know when we see a stranger, whether that stranger is a potential friend or a threat. And one of the ways we do that is by reading faces. So we're not going to soon lose that kind of ability in the human race. And so from that point of view, it's the script is a little bit weak. But having said that, it does have a lot going for it as well. It's about one man's determination to be more than people say he can be. And that's never a bad story to tell. And it reminds me of that old line, which is incredibly useful in a number of things in life. And that line is that the map is not the territory. If you're looking at a map, it's not the same as the landscape. And if you're navigating, the ability to turn the map into the landscape when you see it is a very valuable skill. But the map itself, even if it is Google Maps and or a satellite picture or anything like that, it's just not the same as the territory. There's a complexity to reality that a map doesn't have. And the same can be said for genes and genetic codes. We're much, much more at times and much, much less at other times than our genetic code. And that's basically the heart of this story in the movie. That Vincent, aka Jerome, is told his whole life he's got a heart condition. He's not as tall as his brother is, for instance. His brother is 2 years younger than him. He's not as physically robust as his brother is. And in spite of that, he has an ambition to go to the stars. He wants to travel in space. He wants to go on this mission, which is going to Titan, which is one of the more interesting planets on the solar system because it's got tons of hydrocarbons and it's got oceans of ethane and methane and things like that. So really interesting choice they made there for that to be the place to go to, rather than just falling back on the standard Mars. And Ethan Hawke does a pretty good job playing Vincent. Jude Law, in his first Hollywood film as well, is really good as Jerome, who's bitter and twisted and alcoholic and self-loathing and misanthropic and all of those things when they first get together in order to pull across the deception that Vincent is Jerome. But as the movie goes on, the rapport between the two and the friendship and the regard between them grows. And Jude Law in particular puts that across really well. He's got a complexity of character, which really does help Ethan Hawke's character and Ethan Hawke in his acting to put across the fact that Vincent is so entirely focused on getting into space and achieving something with his life when everybody around him says he can't because of basically what's inside his cells. I suppose there are a few parallels you can make there with being an actor in Hollywood as well. This just occurred to me, that actors in Hollywood pretend to be someone they're not. They have surgery to improve themselves, which indeed Vincent does. He makes himself taller with some very painful leg surgery, and Hollywood actors do go under the knife to improve themselves in some ways. He's focused on his goal very much, very strongly. He works very hard. He pretends to be something he's not to achieve things. Again, it's a parallel between being a jobbing actor and the character in this movie. So there's another one there. But the movie does have also a really interesting look about it. It's a kind of retro look. The suits are very 1950s. The cars are retro type cars, but they put in some sound effects to make them sound like electric cars, which is kind of cool too. The clothing, the sets and the locations are very retro. They've got a very 1940s, 1950s, slightly Art Deco future look. The main building that they use for this is the Marin County Civil Center in California, which they found out leaks when it rains. They had some real problem because it was raining when they were filming there. There's one building they use, which is one of the last buildings Frank Lloyd Wright designed. So they've got all of that kind of retro look. They used all sorts of different locations to put across this future, which is incredibly advanced in some ways. I mean, they can sequence a genome in about 2 seconds. And In spite of that, the cars have a retro look and people are dressed in certain ways, and it's got a feeling that even though it is advanced, in some ways there's a regression to earlier times, which is kind of accurate and useful in the sense that there's segregation based on genetic lineage and genes, which is very much a kind of racism thing. It's talked about as eugenics, but in a sense it's somebody is genetically inferior because of certain qualities that they have. It's not overemphasized in the film, but it's very much a part of the kind of underpinning for the plot of the film. Now, the movie has, it's a kind of, in a way, it's several different kinds of movies. There's a love story in there between Vincent and Irene, where he's hiding a very big secret. She's almost genetically perfect, but has a bit of a heart murmur, which she has to take medication for, which means that she doesn't get to go into space the way Vincent wants to. So you've got the love story thing, you've got the murder of the nameless kind of boss of the place who gets his head beaten in by a computer keyboard. And when they find one of Vincent's eyelash hairs, they automatically assume that because he's genetically invalid, that he's guilty for it. And the whole murder investigation skews in that direction. And most of the cops are chasing down, who is this guy whose genes we found? We've got a picture of him, but we don't know anything about him. He's a kind of mystery to us. But they keep chasing him, assuming that he is the guy who committed murder. Turns out it's not the case. But it's only Alan Arkin playing the older detective, Hugo, his name is, who follows through and makes the investigation what it should be, which is who murdered him, not who shouldn't be where he was murdered, because they're two separate things. And because Alan Arkin is a person of a certain age, it's kind of written in a sense that he too doesn't have his genes optimized because he's older, and he's in a subservient role to the other cops who are a lot younger but are genetically superior. But nonetheless, he's the guy, he's the Columbo of the whole thing, who does the investigation and finds the murderer and does it by old-fashioned police work rather than just relying on genetic technology to lead them in what turns out to be a false trail to the murderer. So you've got the love story, you've got the murder mystery there, you've also got the friendship between Jerome and Vincent, which is makes it a kind of buddy movie in a way. And you've also got the biographical stuff there, where they go from basically Vincent's birth all the way through to his adulthood and show his story. So this movie is a few different things all at once, but I think it holds together quite well. You could see the way that it would be done now on a much bigger budget. There'd be a lot more emphasis on world building and the mise-en-scène around the story. But I think the kind of lowish budget that this movie had works really well, and the people involved were fantastic at turning that limitation into a virtue. The fact that they couldn't just CGI a whole new world meant that they relied on existing buildings, and the existing buildings helped put the story across and helped put the world across, because even with marvellous CG that we have now, 18 years later, there's still a certain kind of emotional and visual weight that a real set has, as opposed to something that's computer generated. There's a level of existence that really can't be done at this stage with CG. And so in Gattaca, using real sets and real locations and giving the movie a retro feel does give it that kind of a complexity to the world building, which it wouldn't have had they had more money to throw around there. The Michael Nyman soundtrack to this movie is very good as well. It doesn't draw attention to itself, but I kind of just deliberately this time listened to it. And it supports the action and the dialogue and everything else really efficiently. And that's indeed how a good soundtrack is in this kind of movie, where the ideas are the thing You don't want the music drawing attention to itself. Gore Vidal, the great writer, playing the director, is kind of a stolid and stiff kind of person to have in this movie. He wasn't particularly gifted as an actor, but he did have a kind of gravitas and a kind of name value that helped the film along in some ways. He's not the best actor in there. Xander Berkeley, who's been in any number of genre films, if you look at his IMDb, he's been in a ton of shit. He's really nice as Dr. Lamar, who basically does the daily urine tests for Vincent/Jerome, and whose character tends to have, whose character we find out at the end has a complex life himself and has, in some very subtle ways, supported Vincent as he climbs to the top of the pyramid. And that's kind of cool. We've got Ernest Borgnine as a cleaner in the movie. There's a couple of nice scenes with Ernie Borgnine in there. They tailored the role to him a little bit, because when you get an actor like Ernest Borgnine, you don't try to get him to stretch himself, particularly when he was in his 70s, maybe around 80 years old at the time. You're not going to get him to create something out of something brand new, but you've got to tailor the role to his strengths. And they do that, and it's nice seeing him in there as well. Tony Shalhoub, I like. His character is very much a straight-up businessman. He's the guy who introduces Vincent to Jerome for a cut of the deal, and he's very efficient and very forthright and businesslike. And his character, even in that short scene, it's got a complexity there, because even though what he's doing is, by the laws of the world he's in, incredibly illegal, he's basically helping people pretend to be somebody they're not. But on the other hand, he's, in a sense, on the side of the angels too, because what he's doing is giving Vincent the opportunity to excel and to show that he can do something, where most people just look at his genetic code and assume that he can't do it. So, in a sense, even though he's making a profit out of it, he's getting a quarter of everything that Vincent earns. German, who's the character that Tony Shalhoub plays, is actually on the side of the angels. He facilitates people to get to their full potential for a dollar. And so, even though in another kind of film, he would be a negative and sleazy character, in this one, he's upright, he's honest, and he gives the character what he needs to get to where he needs to be. So, again, that's the weird thing with this kind of a film. If we run out of our instincts, we think that's a kind of a baddie kind of character. But if you look at it more objectively and from a moral point of view, his character isn't. Nor indeed is Alan Arkin as Hugo. I like this film for a number of reasons. It's not a film that I'm going to watch a lot of times. It's not a film I'm going to watch 10 or 20 times and watch it like every 6 months or something like that. But it does have some important things to say. And it came out at a time when science fiction 2 was more about pretty images than ideas. And it's very much an idea kind of film. Even though the idea is, a bit silly that people are only going to look at someone's DNA and decide what they're going to be and who they are. Nobody's going to do that, because what will happen is, just say you're a company and you start hiring people based on their DNA profile and the fact that they're going to have certain tropes and tendencies and all that kind of shit. Then somebody comes along who looks outside that box and finds much better candidates who aren't just their genetic profile, and does really, really well at it. They get the Jeromes, the Vincents of the world, and they suddenly do a lot better in business than the people who just rely on genetic capacity alone. People are going to stop doing that really fast. The world's a more complex place than just genetic codes, as the movie does posit. But I can't see a company lasting long that just relies on people's genetic profiles for their hiring. I don't think that's going to work for more than about a year or so. After that, people who think outside the box and people who kind of see through the bullshit are going to start getting some really good results from getting people who aren't genetically superior, but who work hard, who have moments of insight. You can't really find a genetic code for being able to put two different ideas together that don't have a relationship with each other and creating something new. That's not something that's genetic. That's something that you need a certain kind of mind, you need a certain kind of influence early in life as well, because you've got to remember this movie, the world is based basically on nature rather than nurture. And we know now, and we probably knew in 1997 as well, that the world is, that the people are a combination of the two. Upbringing is as important as genetics in some ways in determining how well a person does. And that, of course, leads us into one of the other themes of the movie, which is class warfare. And this is very much a movie in some ways about class warfare. The war has been lost by people who are genetically superior, whose parents chose not to or were not rich enough to genetically select the optimum qualities for their children. And that throws away so much human potential, it's ridiculous. But, I mean, well, these movies are, this kind of a story is about, you know, the warning about the dangers of doing a certain thing. So, of course, they've got to exaggerate that certain thing to get their point across, and they do so in this one. But, again, I like the film. Ethan Hawke and Uma Thurman were married for a time. They are no longer married, and I'm not going to make any calls or judgments about that. Lauren Dean is pretty good as Anton, the brother. As I said, Xander Berkeley and all the other character actors in there do a really nice job of supporting the main thrust of the story. The set design is very good. They're very austere, and I think that's a deliberate choice there. I don't know anybody in any business who has workstations that are so boringly dull as the ones in Gattaca, but that's how it goes. And by the way, if people were wondering what Gattaca means, I do have it from the Wikipedia, and I'm going to mispronounce the names of these nuclear bases of DNA, and I do apologize to people, particularly Elaine, for getting this wrong. It's going to be guanine, adenine, thymine, and cytosine, which is the four nuclear bases of DNA. The movie did get an Academy Award nomination for Best Art Direction, and it won a nomination for the Golden Globe Award for Best Original Score. But as I said, it wasn't successful, but it is successful long term. And I'm fascinated by this phenomenon of movies that die in the arse when they come out, but later on end up having a long tail and a well-regarded long term. In fact, this movie is studied in a lot of high schools as well. It's got, yes, it does have people sleeping in a bed together, but it doesn't have any overtly sexual stuff in it. And it's an interesting one to bring up in discussions with kids in school. And there are a number of schools, I believe, in Australia and America where Gattaca is part of the syllabus. And that's great. I like that. It's much better than having, say, Star Wars as part of the syllabus. And so it should be as well. It's it is a rock solid science fiction story, because as I said, it is about the influence of change on humans. And you know, all credit to it for that. I don't think it's perfect. I don't think there is a perfect science fiction movie out there, but I do think it's an honourable attempt to tell a science fiction story and to tell a cautionary tale in an interesting and entertaining way. So that's about it for this time around on Gattaca. I'm going to take another break, and when I get back, it's going to be a lot of fun when I talk about Ant-Man.
40 years ago, I created a suit, but it was dangerous, so I hid it from the world. My assistant, Darren Cross, he became obsessed with recreating my formula. If this technology gets out, it's going to be chaos. Scott, this is your chance to become the hero. I need you to be the Ant-Man.
I think our first move should be calling the Avengers.
The suit has power.
This is not some cute technology like the Iron Man suit.
We're doomed.
When you're small, you have superhuman strength. You like a bullet. So you need to know how to punch.
You want to show me how to punch? Show me how to punch.
Ah, that's how you punch.
Yeah, I got this. Did you think you could stop the future? You're just a thief.
No.
I'm Ant-Man.
I know. Wasn't my idea.
There's no reason to be scared.
Oh, no, no, Daddy don't get scared.
Good.
How'd you do that, bro?
Don't freak out. Look at your shoulder.
Ah! A movie in the Marvel Cinematic Universe always has a ton of expectations about it. It's got a lot of heavy lifting to do with regard to the audience. And there are people who have said that Ant-Man just doesn't do that. But I disagree. I think it's a nice, good, honest Marvel superhero movie as a standalone but linked into the main MCU. Unlike a movie like Age of Ultron, which had a $230 million budget, this one has $130, which is still a substantial budget. And a lot of that, and it's all up there on the screen, really. The CG is fantastic. The miniaturization of Scott Lang into ant-sized human being is incredibly well done. There's a lot of virtue in this film. Of course, it did have that problem of being originally going to be directed and being written by Edgar Wright. There's a lot of talk about the studio interference and all of the problems involved in Edgar Wright leaving the project and Peyton Reed taking it over. But that's all behind the curtain stuff. When you're watching a puppet show, you don't really want to know whether the puppeteers are getting on together beyond a certain... Yeah, there's celebrity gossip in a sense, but this movie, as a standalone, is a lot of fun. It's a different take on the Marvel Cinematic Universe. It's a caper movie, and I always love caper movies. It has engaging characters and engaging actors in it. It has a sense of wonder and a sense of wow about it. If you can see it in 3D, because the 3D works really well to support the story in this one, and it kicks ass from several directions. Okay, I go through the cast, and I like the cast in this movie. I think it works really well for the way the movie plays out. You've got Paul Rudd playing Scott Lang, a very good cat burglar who is engaged by Michael Douglas's character Hank Pym to become the new Ant-Man. We've got Evangeline Lilly playing Hope Van Dyne, the estranged daughter of Hank Pym. And she is the breakout star of this movie. Really, really good. As I said, you've got Corey Stoll playing the bad guy. Bobby Cannavale is in there. He's playing the stepfather of Scott's daughter, a really cute little kid called Cassie. And there are other character actors in the world. Maca Pena is really good as one of Scott's crew who ends up being part of the caper, and he's great because he's a kind of Hispanic metrosexual criminal in a sense, where he knows about art, he knows about wine, he knows about things, but he's really shit at telling stories, and there's a backstory that he has to tell a couple of times, and he always gives the wrong details to tell the story accurately. And he's great in there. He's got just the right tone, and in a sense, even though everybody does get some comedic stuff to do, he really does bring his A game to his character Louise, who is a lot of fun in there. He's really good. It's good to see Judy Greer in another superhero movie. She was, of course, in The Specials, which was one of James Gunn's earlier efforts in around the year 2000, playing a superhero. And Judy Greer plays Maggie, who is Scott Lang's estranged ex-wife. And Michael Douglas's Hank Pym is really good. One of the things people forget about Michael Douglas post-Wall Street is, before he did Wall Street, he could do comedy very well. You've got to remember things like Romancing the Stone, and he brings us back a bit of that Michael Douglas in a really interesting way. The movie starts with a prologue in 1989. Remember 1989? It was in all the newspapers, where Hank Pym is talking things over with S.H.I.E.L.D., including Maggie Carter, Agent Carter, from the TV series and from the Captain America movies. And they suitably age up Hayley Atwell while they de-age Michael Douglas and one of the other characters to show his estrangement from S.H.I.E.L.D. He doesn't want to do this anymore. He has real problems with the technology and the possibility of the technology getting loose, a problem we know from the Iron Man technologies as well. Most of the technological Marvel Cinematic Universe stuff is a potential threat to the human race, and the Ant-Man technology is no different. He then leaves and hides the technology after a certain incident occurred. He really doesn't want to do this anymore and becomes a semi-recluse, starts a company called PIM Technologies, or PIMTech, which is eventually taken over by Darren Cross, the Corey Stoll character, who then starts to try to replicate the Ant-Man technology with his Yellow Jacket project. And of course, Yellow Jacket was one of the villains in the original Ant-Man comics. So Darren Cross is getting very, very close to cracking the technology. And so Hank Pym decides what he's going to do is he needs somebody to sabotage, go into PymTech, which is now being called CrossTech, and sabotage the whole thing so that he destroys Darren Cross's attempts to get the technology that Pym almost perfected, not quite perfected, but came very, very close to perfecting 40 years before. And he needs a really good cat burglar, hence his engagement with Scott Lang, who's just got out of San Quentin. He wants to rebuild his life. He doesn't want to go back to crime. He wants to be able to pay his child support and get visitation rights with his young daughter and basically, you know, be a straight upright human being. Even though his crew, played by Michael Peña, Chip Harris, and David Dashmalchian, David Dashmalchian, who plays Kurt, the other member of his heist gang. And so you've got, on the one side, you've got Scott trying to be an upright human being, but because of circumstance and nobody wants to hire an ex-con, being drawn toward going back to crime. You've got Hank Pym, who needs a really good cat burglar like Scott. Like, he's got a degree in electrical engineering, he's a parkour wizard, and he's just the sort of guy that's needed to resurrect Ant-Man for the one caper. There are some good scenes before Pym meets Scott Lang, which show his Scott Lang's chops as somebody who's really good at a caper and does a one-man break-in into a certain old mansion in San Francisco, finds that things aren't quite what he thought they are, comes up with innovative and very cool solutions to them on the spot. He's got 20 minutes before the alarm system is going to be running again, so the clock is ticking, and he does that really well. There's a touch of Rafifi there. It really does set up the character as being resourceful, courageous, and very, very good at his job. So there's a nice setup there. As a result of this, Scott has his first encounter with the Ant-Man suit and ends up going from way upstairs in the hotel he's staying in, which has a very cool name I'm not going to spoil, but if you know your comics, you'll get the chuckle out of the name of the hotel. Basically, he shrinks down, ends up outside the building by some very innovative means, and then a voice comes into the helmet of the Ant-Man suit telling him who he is and what he needs to do. And the CG on this is fantastic. Now, I actually know somebody who worked on the effects in this film, a guy I know called Bruce Creevy, who I want to get on a future podcast just to talk about what he does. Bruce actually worked on the water pipe scene in this movie and a scene or two other. I forget exactly what he told me on Facebook, but we're meeting up for lunch during the week, so I'm going to kind of find out a little bit more about what Bruce did with this. He's worked on a number of movies. He did I, Frankenstein, and told me that it was going to be a piece of shit, which was totally accurate, and a number of other things. So he's big on CG, and he's going to be a very interesting guest. I am definitely getting onto a future Martian Drive-In podcast. But leaving that aside, the computer technology here works. It supports the story. It is fantastically good. There are some marvelous set pieces. There's a battle between Ant-Man and Yellow Jacket, and yes, it's no spoiler to say that they're going to fight because it's in the trailer, which takes place inside a briefcase full of stuff which has just fallen out of a helicopter. And that's a real incredibly fun piece of work. It involves keys and mobile phones and all sorts of other stuff in there, and it's just beautifully done. A packet of lifesavers gets involved as well, and yeah, I mean, the action scenes in this movie are breathtaking and fun, and that's the thing that I've got to emphasize with this movie. People are so used to the bombastic, enormous nature of things like Age of Ultron and a number of the other movies in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, that this much smaller scale story, yes, even though it does involve breaking into a large corporation and destroying some technology, and there's some explosions and some other stuff in there, it doesn't trash entire cities, it doesn't slam dunk a European town into the ground, it doesn't do any of those things. It's a much more human scale story, and in that sense it's a breather from the great big things. It's a kind of breathing space between Age of Ultron and Captain America Civil War, which is probably, I think, the next Marvel Cinematic Universe movie to come out. So it's in that sense it's good stuff, and it's nice that they've kind of paced it so that they put this one in there. It gives another character to put into future movies, and they're one of the little bits at the end of the film, those two little buttons you get during the credit sequences, does indicate that Ant-Man will be appearing in Captain America Civil War as a character and an important plot point in there. I'm not doing any spoilers to say what goes on there, but it's useful to know that. And he is very much a different kind of character. Scott Lang's a different kind of person than the people we've seen playing Marvel superheroes in the past, in the sense that he's an ex-criminal, he comes from a totally different world, he's not bulked up and buff. Paul Rudd in this is kind of leaned down. He's very fit in the movie, but he's not kind of muscly in that sense. He's more agile and nimble and kind of lean rather than the other way around. And he's come to see from things from a different viewpoint. He's a family man in a sense. He's got a broken family. He's divorced from his wife. He's got a daughter as well, a young child. And that kind of puts him in a different headspace anyway, and makes him very different from, say, Tony Stark, or definitely Thor, or even Ruffalo's Hulk, or any of the others. The universe is getting expanded in a nice way by having this character in there. And also, there are things that lead into movies like Doctor Strange. Another aspect to the reality of the Marvel Cinematic Universe is revealed when Scott's suit malfunctions. And again, that's an important plot point, but I'm not going to give away what it is. But it does lead into movies like Doctor Strange, and that's kind of cool too. This universe has its own mythology, its own cosmology, and its own physics in some senses. And this movie, even though it is, as I said, a smaller and lighter piece of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, does work to cement together the next stage of that Marvel Cinematic Universe in some ways. And that's not an easy thing to do in a two-hour movie as well. The movie is packed with stuff. It's never not interesting. I mean, there are some people who said there are slow bits in it and there are cliches in it, but any cliches that are in it I could really embrace, because they were part of the character building. Everybody in the film is a joy to watch doing what they do. There's no people that piss you off in there. There's some bits with a baby lamb, which is a bit icky, but it does enable us to see what kind of person Darren Cross is. The universe, and one of the things too with Hank Pym and his technologies, which apparently developed in about 1963 to 1965 originally, it does give us historic backstory to the time between Captain America first being created and the 21st century. So that, in a sense, while they're looking forward into the future of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, there are some bits and pieces that backfill the history of the Marvel Cinematic Universe in some interesting ways, and I do like that. I find that this kind of mosaic and this timeline they're creating really interesting. And yes, it's a juggling act. There are so many different aspects to it. There's so much money involved, there's reputations involved, and there's the future of the franchise itself involved in pretty much everything they do. I think that this movie works well to be part of the cement holding that together. While I think they did go a bit off track in some ways with Age of Ultron, With this one, because they pulled back a little bit and are telling a much smaller story, which does link into the larger stories, but not in a way that overwhelms this story itself, I think that it bodes well for the future. I think that the way it seems to be going is there are going to be the big bombastic over-the-top Marvel Cinematic Universe movies in future. There have to be if you're going to fight Thanos and all that kind of thing. But I like the fact that there are also going to be different kinds of different sub-genres of movie in this universe. You had the space opera, the Guardians of the Galaxy. With this one, you've got the caper film. You had the spy thriller with the last Captain America movie, Winter Soldier. And within the universe, they're giving a bit of flexibility to the genre, which is kind of cool. And I think works well. But the other risk in doing that, though, is that you're going to hit genres that people don't particularly like. I mean, some people don't like caper films. Don't know why, but apparently they are. And so, you know, that's not going to be for them. Some people don't like certain actors, it's not going to be for them. But I do think one of the things this movie does open up is a new potential female superhero for the Marvel Cinematic Universe who is going to be cool and is going to be very much her own person. Not doing any more spoilers on that, but that definitely is a step in the right direction. And the words she speaks as that occurs in the movie are very important as well. So, as I said, I'm not going to spoil that, but yeah, is what I thought when I was watching that bit. Now, this movie isn't going to make the kind of money that Age of Ultron or even Guardians of the Galaxy made, but I don't know whether it was intended to be that scale. It's going to definitely make a profit. In the first weekend, they've already made more than half of the costs back. So, as things pan out over the next 6 months with the next weeks in the cinema, then the DVD and Blu-ray and streaming rights and all that kind of thing, this movie's definitely not going to be a failure at all. The numbers on it are at least as good as the second Thor movie. In fact, they're better than the second Thor movie based on the budget of that film. And I think in that sense, it's going to, you know, not be just a big failure that people are anticipating from this franchise. And it'd be nice if there wasn't one. I mean, I don't like movies that fail. I like movies that are successful. I like movies that are good. But there are always people who go to a car race to see crashes. And in a sense, the Marvel Cinematic Universe is the biggest car race in cinema at the moment, with the possible future exception of the Star Wars franchise, which from the projects that they're purporting to do, like Guillermo del Toro wants to do Jabba the Hutt origin story, and they're going to do a young Han Solo origin story and things like that. And nah, I mean, yes, the next Star Wars movie will make a shit ton of money. As to whether it'll be any good or not, we'll see. I've seen the extended trailer and all the extra bits at the moment, and not being a Star Wars fan, I think it's too kind of fan wank to really have a long-term success. That's just my theory, and I'm going to be proven wrong probably, but that's just my theory that, whereas the Marvel Cinematic Universe is doing something interesting, and even though it does acknowledge that you've got to jerk off the fans, it takes things in potentially controversial directions and pulls rabbits out of its hat. The nice thing about Marvel is they've got so much backstory and so much back product which hasn't appeared in the 60-year history of Marvel Comics, that they can go lateral the way they did with Guardians of the Galaxy and go somewhere totally different and make it successful if they just do it right. But if you haven't seen Ant-Man, I recommend it if you're into superhero movies. It's fun. Go in there looking for a light bit of entertainment because it's not too much more than that. It's got some very, very well done special effects and well chosen too. The things they choose to portray in any kind of special effects movie are at least as important as the story in some ways. And this movie chooses what it does really well. And you get sucked right into believing that a man could be ant-sized and doing all sorts of interesting things and almost telepathically controlling different species of ants. There are some very nice ants in this movie as well. And they Yeah, the answer, another important thing of it too, it shows us another side of the superpowers in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Everybody else's superpower is intrinsic to themselves, whereas the superpower that the suit gives Scott Lang is extended beyond himself. He can control ants, and that in itself means that he can get through this caper successfully, because like his crew, the ants are an intrinsic part of the caper, and that's kind of cool. So highly recommend Ant-Man as a lighter part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, as a good kind of binding together of the universe in a lot of ways, and just as a bit of entertainment. It's not deep, it's not insightful about human existence, but it's a good solid entertainment, and that's not to be sneezed at. Anyway, I'm going to wrap things up there because my throat is giving out and the sun is getting low in the west. So I'm going to, of course, do the credits in the style of cinema credits for the people who have supported this podcast and Paleo Cinema via the Patreon campaign. Thank you for listening. Thank you for watching good films. And I'll be back in 2 weeks' time with yet another Martian Driving podcast, in a week's time with a Paleo Cinema podcast. So keep watching the skies. Take care of yourselves. Have some fun. Go see Ant-Man. Enjoy yourself. And I'll be back very soon. And here are the credits for the Patreon subscribers to the podcast in the style of movie credits. I'd like to thank Tom the Focus Puller, Sarah the Special Effects Technician, Ian the Caterer, Grant the Technicolor Consultant, Claire the Script Doctor, Gary the Prop Master, Morris the Musical Director, Jan the Dialect Coach, Armin the Key Grip, Matt the Rattlesnake Wrangler, Elaine our Scientific Advisor, Julia our Casting Director, Chris our Camera Operator, Christopher our Gaffer, Miss Jane our Wardrobe Mistress, Tansy the Foley Artist, Alyssa our Location Scout, Mark our Second Unit Director, Paul our Special Makeup Effects Director, Tammy the Donut Wrangler, Tim the New York Unit Director, and Rabbi Steve our Spiritual Advisor. So thank you to everybody who supports the podcast and to the people who listen to it. If you want to support the podcast with some micropayments, please go to patreon.com/paleocinema. And I'll catch all of you next time.